It's Thursday, December 12, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. This week, the United States Senate confirmed Patricia A. Millett to serve on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. That's the nation's second most powerful court because so many challenges to federal laws arrive at that circuit because the federal government is housed in Washington, D.C. And that court has been, until now, evenly divided between judges appointed by Republican and Democratic presidents. There were four Republicans, four Democrats by nomination. Now, President Obama has announced his intention to reshape that court by adding three new justices, giving democratically appointed judges a three-vote majority. In the Roosevelt administration, this was known as court packing, and the American people protested it vehemently. But now President Obama is moving ahead. He can only move ahead, however, because the United States Senate changed its rules. The Democrats in the United States Senate eliminated the filibuster for presidential nominations, and that is the reason why Patricia Millett is now confirmed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and why she'll be serving, expecting two additional nominees to that court from President Obama soon there to arrive. All this points to the increasing power of the federal judiciary. When you look back to our constitutional order in the era of the framing, when you look at the founders and their intention about the court, there's nothing in the Constitution, nor in the Federalist Papers or other material of the time, that indicates that they saw the court as having the overwhelming influence that it has now in so many issues of public policy. So many of the most contentious issues of our conversation, from a Christian worldview in terms of importance, are dealt with by the courts. Issues like abortion, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, religious liberty, you go down the line, so many of these issues arrive for their ultimate determination in this culture now at our courts. And of all the courts, this is the second most important of the courts in America. President Obama knows it. The Republicans in the Senate know it. And so do the Democrats. That gets to another issue. Jonathan Martin, reporting for the New York Times, tells us that President Obama and Democratic moderates now find themselves being outgunned politically by the leftists in their own party. The headline reads, Coalition of Liberals strikes back at criticism from centrist Democrats. But as Martin reports, in a sign of the left's new aggressiveness, a coalition of liberals is trying to marginalize a centrist Democratic policy group that was responsible for a Wall Street Journal op-ed article that recently appeared that said economic populism was disastrous for the party. This is a very interesting development. For the last several years, a lot of the argument about what's going on amongst the parties was concentrated on the Republican Party. Headline after headline has indicated a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. There have been all kinds of political analyses offered about different portions of the Democratic Party, different constituencies, and how they are vying for supremacy within the Republican Party, its presidential nomination process, its primaries, and all the rest. But as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have recently made very clear, it may well be that going into the next election cycles, the developments on the Democratic side might be actually far more interesting. One of the big pictures in American politics and culture over the last several decades has been that in so many economic and political issues, not moral issues, the Democratic left has been in something of a retreat. This follows what might be called a pendulum theory of American government and its progress, where you have a liberal era that is followed by the reaction of a conservative era that then swings the other direction. And so you have the Roosevelt era, and then you have the Eisenhower era, and then you have the big government of Lyndon Baines Johnson, and you'd have to include in that Richard Nixon, and then you have the response to that with Ronald Reagan and those who followed him on the Republican side. The argument is now that on the Democratic side, there's a pendulum going to the left. But as this article and others have made very clear, it's not just the left in general. It's the rather hard left of the Democratic Party that is now gaining in influence and ascendancy. As Martin reports, the liberal group's campaign is already getting results, the latest indication that the liberal wing of the Democratic Party is ascendant. A very interesting statement in the New York Times. Of course, the New York Times, both in terms of the worldview of those writing and editing it on the one hand, and those who read it on the other, are expected to be very pleased with that kind of analysis, to be hopeful that it could indeed be true. However, what's really interesting is that the Democrats and much of the rest of the country, not on the two coasts, those who have to get elected or reelected in places in the heartland of America, are afraid that if their party once again gets positioned as the party of the hard left, they're going to be out of a job. This gets to a very interesting political dynamic in America. America, in terms of its voting center, really is a centrist nation. The argument is whether, in terms of the international scene, it's center-left or center-right, but the American people have shown a demonstrated resistance to moving too far in any one direction. Now, is that because they're of a divided mind or they're just moderate and somehow in the middle of the political spectrum? Well, that's part of it, but the bigger issue is this. The American population, the voting population as a whole, is broken up into several different constituencies. No one of these constituencies can elect a president. In order to elect a president, the candidate has to appeal to multiple of these constituencies. In other words, has to put together a voting coalition large enough to get the electoral votes to get him into office. So in other words, it's not, as many would suggest, that it's individual Americans who are so moderate. It's that individual Americans don't individually elect a president. It takes different concentrations and collectives of voters to get there. And the interesting point in all of this, from a worldview analysis, is that amongst the Democrats, virtually everyone now sees the left, indeed the hard left of that party, as ascendant. What does that add up to? A very interesting and quite honest debate within that party and within the nation about the future this nation should take. Yesterday marked the fifth anniversary of the Madoff scandal. 5 years ago, Bernie Madoff and his Ponzi scheme were revealed to the American public in the most catastrophic fall of such a project in the nation's history. It was the largest Ponzi scheme in American history. It racked up about $17.3 billion in losses. That's over $17 billion in losses. One of the most interesting aspects of this is what this tells us not only about the human nature of Bernie Madoff in terms of his intention to steal from people and to keep his Ponzi scheme going as long as he could. It tells us about the moral character of those who were involved in the Ponzi scheme as well. Let's unpack this a little bit. What you had here is one of those situations that proverbially looked too good to be true. Bernie Madoff's funds were returning far more than comparative funds, and those who were investing in it and reaping such returns, or at least apparent returns, were quite unwilling to ask the questions that perhaps other people would have asked about how indeed these returns could be so much higher than those in other funds. In the meantime, Bernie Madoff had the reputation as one who could pull these things off. He had the reputation on Wall Street and elsewhere as one who could perform financial magic. And yet, as almost always is the case, financial magic isn't real. And the fall of this house was indeed very great, as the Bible demonstrates. The fall of this house came with over $17 billion in losses, leading to many questions. What was Bernie Madoff actually trying to do? Well, here you have someone who established a Ponzi scheme, named for an Italian who first pioneered this kind of thing to the extent that it was named for him. You're talking about a scheme in which money is taken in, and the money has to keep coming in because it's actually not buying real value. It's being paid out in minimal sums to keep people in the project, believing that they eventually will vastly gain. And yet, of course, the fall of every one of these can be predicted because eventually not enough money is coming in to meet the minimal requirements of what should go out. And then when someone looks behind the curtain, there's nothing there. In this case, nothing but Bernie Madoff. And Bernie Madoff, of course, pled guilty without a trial in terms of the massive charges against him. There is no doubt he will spend the rest of his life in jail. All that he'd once had in terms of riches, it's all turned to dust. By the way, the authorities trying to put all of this back together, they've been able to come up with about $11 billion of the $17 billion lost, but this amounts to massive ruined lives and, indeed, a fall in this project that was so great that it affected the United States economy. A couple of things have come of late that, from a Christian worldview perspective, are particularly interesting. One is the fact that there are others who were colleagues of Bernie Madoff who are now either trying to make the best deal they can or are expected soon to face trial. One of them is Frank Pascali. He has implicated his former boss and co-workers in fabricating, as USA Today says, decades of backdated trading records and gains, crafting bogus financial documents to fool auditors and other alleged wrongdoing, all while collecting millions of dollars in salaries and company perks. As USA Today's Kevin McCoy reports, the portrayal by the former Madoff finance lieutenant showed that the scam that vaporized investments, savings, and plans of thousands of ordinary investors, celebrities, charities, and others was so intricate it required willing or unwitting record alterations and other work from dozens of employees, end quote. What do we gain from that? Oh, we gain a lot. When it comes to wrongdoing, when it comes to what Christians know to call sin, it turns out that the sinner has to work really hard at this kind of organized, institutionalized sin. You know, psychologists tell us that it takes a certain amount of intelligence to lie, and that only the very intelligent can pull off massive lies. And yet, it also takes a lot of intelligence to come up with this kind of evil scam. It takes a lot of intelligence, a lot of determination to try to keep the records straight, to try to keep everything straight so that you don't get caught. The criminal has to work a lot harder than someone doing an honest business. That's the side of this that's so amazing. If Bernie Madoff had actually run a legitimate fund, he would have been a billionaire, and those who had invested in his fund would have come out well. He was working so hard, he actually had the intelligence, he had the Wall Street savvy, he could have made a legitimate business work, but legitimacy was not good enough for him. He didn't want what you could get through a legitimate investment scheme. He wanted the vast income, the unrealistic financial magic for which he was known. There's another side of this, however, and it isn't about Bernie Madoff, but those who invested in his Ponzi scheme. Why did they do this? Why did they keep their money in there so long? Why did they have such trust in Bernie Madoff? It is because, as these news reports have made so abundantly clear, when it comes to the opportunity for gain, we often deny ourselves the luxury of reality. We fool ourselves into thinking that maybe we're just smart enough to invest with someone who's smart enough to beat the game, to the extent that the returns would be overwhelmingly positive, far beyond what might come through any other source or investment opportunity. The adage is true. If it looks too good to be true, it probably is. The law of averages on Wall Street and the financial laws of logic tell us that there cannot be this kind of performance, certainly over any length of time, that is so much greater than the economy with no apparent difference in the investment policies. What we're looking at here is the fact that human beings, those who are involved in these schemes, who have to invest more than they would have to invest if it were legitimate, and those who are involved in it unwittingly, that's the word used in USA Today, they're involved in a common co-conspiracy to deny themselves the truth and to involve themselves in an illusion they think will be real, or real enough at least, that they will win in the end. But you look at Bernie Madoff and you look at those who invested in his funds and you look at the pathetic nature of humanity that is reflected there, and then you realize, when I look in the mirror, I see the same thing. Because this is just a picture of human sin in every specific form and in its general texture. We fool ourselves into thinking this will work for us, when not only does experience tell us it will not, God himself has declared you won't get away with this. You may think you will, but just wait. The fall of that house will be very great. Well, here's the kind of headline you can expect to see in years to come. The headline is from Religion News Service, article by David Gibson. Catholic high school fires teacher who applied for gay marriage license. Gibson tells the story. The man's Michael Griffin. He was teaching in a suburban Catholic high school in Philadelphia. He taught there for more than a decade. But as Gibson reports last week, when he told administrators at Holy Ghost Preparatory School that he was going to marry his partner, he was fired. Then says Religion News Service, the episode is the latest in a string of similar incidents, and it came just a week after New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan said the church is not anti-gay, but has been out-marketed on the issue of gay marriage. Gibson goes on to explain that Griffin is himself an alumnus of Holy Ghost School. He taught languages there for 12 years. He was dismissed on December the 6th after he met with the president of the school, the Reverend James McCloskey. The interesting twist in this story is that the man who was fired, Michael Griffin, says it was already well known in the school he was gay. He and his partner, Vincent Gianetto, both wear rings. A school administrator came to the reception for their civil union in 2008, and the pair frequently attended school parties as a couple, including a big fundraiser in April. The man who was fired then went on to say, to me, that was much more public than me emailing the principal, so I don't understand if they were going to fire me, why not in April? Why not for the civil union? Why not at the first time I brought my partner to the school? That's why it's kind of a shock to me, end quote. Well, it's an interesting picture any way you look at it, as is reported by Religion News Service. The interesting twist here is that the man claims, at least, that his homosexuality was known before he was fired for announcing he was going to marry his homosexual partner. That is an interesting twist, and one of the things we learn from that is it's not enough to all of a sudden come up with a moral conviction about homosexuality. If it's legitimate, if homosexuality is the concern, as amongst Christians, it must be on biblical terms, then it has to be the concern regardless of whether the issue marriage arrives or not. The issue of same-sex marriage here is a bit late to get to, but that's just taking this man at his word. I do not have any particular knowledge of the case. The larger issue and the larger lesson for us is that if a school, in this case a Catholic boys prep school in suburban Philadelphia, a Catholic school fires a teacher for being gay, thus for violating the terms of his contract, for violating the moral expectations of the school and the official teachings of the church, here's the bottom line. You can expect a headline like this: Catholic high school fires teacher who applied for a gay marriage license. In other words, this is news. The news media and many in other sectors of our society think that this is such a scandalous development that it's headline news. Now, what we're looking at is something very simple to understand. The man violated his contract by a moral behavior the school says and teaches on the basis of its religious beliefs is wrong and sinful. He knew that when he accepted employment, and now he appears to be shocked when, having announced his violation of that policy, he is terminated. But the national media, not just the religious media, but many in the secular media as well, are so scandalized by that it becomes headline news. Well, just wait. That headline news is likely to arrive very close to where you are, and probably in short order. Another reason for this is that many people think that by making this headline news, people will be intimidated from taking the action their convictions imply. That's going to be a very interesting test for religious organizations. I'm in no position to speak here for the Catholic school or for the Catholic Church, but for evangelicals, I will say this. This is a crucial test for us. In this case, two things to learn. You can't show up all of a sudden with a concern about homosexuality or about the Bible's teachings on human sexuality. And second, you better be ready for a headline when you do what your convictions demand and hold someone to the contract that includes the moral expectations your denomination or church believes to be revealed in Scripture. Finally, a very interesting headline in the New York Times. The headline is this: Baffling 400,000-year-old clue to human origins. This is a complex article in scientific terms. It, of course, is based in a debate amongst evolutionists and a supposed finding that was made in Spain. What is claimed to be ancient DNA from 400,000 years ago, whereas the previous record had been, according to their claim, about 100,000 years ago. But the big issue from the Christian worldview significance is this. Without getting into the details of the article is demonstrating that this supposed find, now reported out of Spain, is completely upending the received and inherited model of the dominant understanding of human evolution. And what we're talking about here is just one DNA test, or the test of one DNA group, that is demonstrating what is already upending the entire story. In other words, when we're talking about the dominant theory of evolution, it's not so dominant nor so stable as people might like you to think. The language in Carl Zimmer's article is very interesting. The scientists are now, quote, rethinking human evolution over the past few 100,000 years. Matthias Maier, a geneticist from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, said, quote, right now we've basically generated a big question mark, end quote. Juan Luis Arzuaga, a paleoanthropologist at University of Madrid, co-author of the paper, said, quote, now we have to rethink the whole story, end quote. So when those who are the advocates of the evolutionary worldview tell you that evolution is a proved fact and that it is a stable theory, just remember how often in any given year these kind of headlines come, where all of a sudden evolutionists are having to completely rethink the way they argue that evolution actually happened. What isn't assailable in terms of their research is whether evolution happened. That's their worldview, and they're committed to it. But the how? It's not even a stable argument anymore, as this article in the New York Times makes very clear. Carl Zimmer makes that point himself with this interesting sentence, quote, the new finding is hard to reconcile with the picture of human evolution that has been emerging based on fossils and ancient DNA. Well, go figure. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing. We'll be right back.